Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. When you think about writers who really tapped into the anxieties of the modern age, Franz Kafka is almost in a class by himself. His name, it's more than just a name, isn't it? It's become like an adjective.
It really has, Kafka-esque. And it comes from this man, Kafka, a German-speaking Jew in Prague, trained as a lawyer, actually worked in insurance. You can just imagine the daily grind with bureaucracy he experienced.
Yeah, and that experience clearly fed directly into his writing. We should probably define Kafka-esque right up front, shouldn't we? Because it's so central to understanding him, especially for, you know, anyone learning about him. What does it mean?
Well, fundamentally, it describes experiences that feel utterly bizarre, illogical, tangled, but also deeply oppressive. What makes Kafka unique, though, is the way he writes about it.
How so?
He uses this incredibly precise, clear, almost clinical language to describe these, well, nightmarish scenarios. The absurdity is presented matter-of-factly, which just ramps up the feeling of dread, you know?
And that feeling is maybe nowhere more potent than in the novel we're diving into today, The Trial, or The Process in the original German, written around 1914, 1915.
Right. And famously, we almost didn't get to read it. His friend, Max Brod, was told explicitly to burn all the manuscripts after Kafka died young in 1924.
Thankfully, he didn't listen.
Thank goodness, no. Because The Trial, even though it's technically unfinished, it's just this absolute cornerstone of modernist literature, of understanding 20th century paranoia.
So our goal today is really to unpack this story, this powerful allegory about guilt, about that existential dread, and, well, the individual just getting crushed by forces they can't understand or fight. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it. Where better to start than that opening line? It's one of the most famous in literature.
It really just drops you right in, doesn't it?
Instantly. Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K., for without having done anything wrong, he was arrested one fine morning.
Boom. Just like that. And Joseph K., he's not some marginal figure, right? He's a respectable bank official, doing well.
Exactly. A senior clerk, lives an orderly life, and then, on his 30th birthday, these two agents show up in his rented room. They tell him he's under arrest.
But, and this is where it gets really weird. He's not taken to jail.
No. That's the first huge absurdity. He's arrested, yet he's told he can continue his life, go to work at the bank, just have, as long as he shows up for these periodic court proceedings.
And the charge. What did they say he did?
Nothing. It's never specified. Not to him, not to the reader. Ever.
Wow. So right away, you see this clash. K's mind, it's logical, rational, used to the clear rules of finance. Mm. And he's suddenly thrown into this system that operates on completely different, totally obscure principles. The power isn't in handcuffs. It's in the not knowing. The ambiguity itself is the weapon.
Precisely. And his first reaction is, well, indignation. He thinks it's a mistake, a misunderstanding he can clear up with logic.
So he tries to engage with it rationally.
He does. He gets summoned for his first interrogation. But the court, it's not in some grand building.
No, where is it?
It convenes in these cramped, stuffy, almost squalid attic rooms and tenement buildings, hidden away in the poorest parts of the city.
That's unsettling, sort of hiding in plain sight.
Very much so. And Kay, he goes there, finds this bizarre assembly, and he actually gives this confident, defiant speech denouncing the whole process, the inefficiency, the corruption he assumes must be behind it.
Trying to use his professional logic against it.
Exactly. Like, he's given a presentation to inefficient colleagues. But here's the crucial thing. His logic, his arguments about justice and reason, they have absolutely zero effect.
The system just doesn't care about that stuff.
It seems completely indifferent to it. It runs on its own internal inscrutable rules. The accusation itself, the process is the punishment. It just starts wearing him down, creating this constant state of anxiety.
That anxiety, it's psychological at first, but then it becomes much more real, much more brutal, doesn't it? Where do we see the system showing its teeth.
Oh, that shift is stark. It happens in maybe the most jarring scene, I think, where the court's violence suddenly bursts into Kay's normal, ordered world, his workplace.
You mean the incident with the flogger?
Yes, exactly. Kay is at his bank, his place of business, and he happens upon this small, dusty storage room. And inside,
what does he find?
He finds the two warders, the men who initially arrested him, being savagely whipped by this figure called the flogger.
Whipped? Why?
Apparently for some minor misconduct related to Kay's arrest, like complaining or trying to take his belongings. Kay is absolutely horrified, tries to stop it, argues with the flogger, but he's powerless. The violence is just there, arbitrary. and it's happening in his bank.
That must have been a profound shock. It completely shatters that idea that he can keep his case separate from his real life.
Totally. It shows him his rational arguments mean nothing, and that this process has real, violent, unpredictable consequences that can follow him anywhere. It's not just paperwork. It's physical brutality, used almost randomly. That's how the system controls him, not with walls, but with this kind of psychological terror.
So after that, his defiance starts to crumble.
Yeah, the intellectual confidence takes a massive hit. He starts getting desperate, realizes he needs help navigating this thing. So he decides to seek legal assistance. He hires a lawyer, Herr Hold.
Okay, so maybe things will get clearer now. He's got a lawyer.
Well, Hold is hardly a beacon of clarity or action. He's another perfect Kafkaesque figure, actually.
So?
Hold is this elderly, bedridden advocate who seems to thrive on obfuscation. He talks endlessly about his supposed connections within the court's lower levels, but never seems to make actual legal arguments. He fosters this dependency in his clients.
Sounds frustrating.
Deeply. And adding to the strange, almost sickly atmosphere is Hold's nurse, Lanny. She seems to have this weird attraction, almost a fetish, for accused men. She tries to seduce Kay, pulling him further into this murky, stagnant world.
So the lawyer is basically useless, just spinning his wheels.
Pretty much. And Kay gets a terrifying glimpse of where this path leads when he meets another of Hold's clients, a man named Block.
Block the merchant. What's his story?
Block has been tangled up in his own trial, represented by Hold, for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
5 years. And he's been reduced to this pitiful, subservient state, practically living in Hold's apartment, treated, as the text explicitly says later, like a dog.
Oh, wow. So Kay sees his own potential future right there.
Exactly. This utter degradation, this complete loss of dignity and agency, seeing Block is a turning point. Kay, in a moment of defiance, maybe his last real one fires Hold.
Good for him. But does it help?
Not really. Dismissing Hold doesn't dismiss the case. It just continues to hang over him, consuming his thoughts, his energy.
So the official legal channels are a dead end. Where does he turn next?
He needs some kind of inside track, right?
He thinks so. He gets wind of this painter, Titterelli, who apparently has connections. He's an official court painter, believe it or not.
A court painter? What does that even mean?
It's never fully clear,
mm-hmm.
But Titterelli works out of this tiny, stifling, hot studio, also in a poor area, and he's constantly surrounded by these strange, almost menacing young girls who seem linked to the court somehow. It's another bizarre, oppressive environment.
And Titorelli, does he offer Kay any real hope, any secrets?
He offers Kay something, but it's not hope, it's devastating clarity. He basically confirms Kay's worst fears about the system.
Which are?
Titorelli tells him flat out, a genuine final acquittal, a verdict saying you are innocent. That's impossible. The court simply doesn't issue them.
Impossible. So you can never be cleared.
According to Titorelli, no. The system isn't built for resolutions like innocence or guilt in the way we understand them. So if he can't win, what can he do? What are the options Titorelli lays out? Is it like being stuck in bureaucratic limbo forever?
That's a pretty good way to put it. Titorelli says there are basically two possibilities, neither of them good. The first is called apparent acquittal.
Apparent acquittal, meaning?
Meaning you get temporarily released, the case files are sort of put aside, but the charges can be reactivated at any moment by higher unseen judges. You're basically on permanent probation, never truly free.
Okay, not great. What's the other option?
Indefinite postponement. This means using connections, like Titorelli's, to constantly intervene and keep the case stuck in its earliest stages. It never progresses towards a judgment, but it also never ends. It just requires constant effort, constant vigilance, forever.
My God. So either live with the constant threat of the case returning, or spend your entire life actively keeping it at bay.
Precisely. The big takeaway from Titorelli is that Kay's whole quest for justice, for a clear resolution, it's chasing an illusion. Victory isn't possible. The best you can hope for is managing the defeat, just keeping your head above water in this endless process.
That feels like the philosophical breaking point, which leads us, I suppose, towards the end and that encounter in the cathedral.
Yes, near the end of the novel, Kay is supposed to meet an Italian client for the bank at the city's main cathedral. The client doesn't show, but someone else does.
The prison chaplain?
The prison chaplain, or priest. He calls down to Kay from the pulpit in the vast, dark, empty church. He knows Kay's name, knows about his case. He tells Kay his case is going badly.
And then he tells him that story, the parable.
The famous parable before the law. It's kind of the symbolic heart of the novel.
Can you quickly summarize it for us? It's so potent.
Hey, sure. It's about a man from the country who comes seeking admittance to the law. He finds a gate guarded by a doorkeeper. The doorkeeper tells him he can't enter right now, but maybe later.
So the man waits.
He waits for days, years, his entire life. He tries bribing the doorkeeper, asking questions, but he never gets past him. Finally, as the man is dying, old and frail, he asks the doorkeeper one last question. How come nobody else ever came seeking entry here?
And the answer?
The doorkeeper shouts at the dying man, "No one else could ever gain admittance here because this entrance was meant solely for you. I am now going to close it."
Chilling. It's like, the path exists only for you, but you're specifically barred from ever taking it.
Exactly. It encapsulates the entire paradox of Kay's situation and maybe existence itself in Kafka's view. The law is there. It's personal, but it's fundamentally inaccessible. Kay and the priest debate its meaning. Who's deceived, who's subordinate.
But the core message seems inescapable. There's a line they discuss, something about logic.
Yes, the priest quotes an interpretation. The logic of the law is indeed unshakable, but it cannot withstand a man who wants to live.
So the system's internal logic might be perfect, but it's completely at odds with the basic human need to live, to act, to find meaning. That feels like the final nail in the coffin for Kay's struggle.
It really does. After that conversation, the sense of doom is palpable. The system is indifferent, impenetrable. It has won.
And the ending itself is just stark, cold.
Utterly. On the evening before Kay's 31st birthday, a year exactly since his arrest began, two men arrive at his apartment.
How are they described?
They're formal, pale, stout, dressed in top hats and frock coats, almost like grotesque bureaucrats or undertakers. Kay doesn't fight anymore. The narrative says he offers only weary resignation.
He just goes with them.
He does. They link arms with him, guiding him firmly through the city streets, out towards the edge of town, to a small deserted quarry.
No trial, no verdict, just...
just this silent procedural execution. It's the ultimate anticlimax. They lay him down on the ground near a rock.
And then...
one man takes out a long, thin, double-edged butcher's knife. He passes it over Kay's head to the other man, who then leans over Kay, plunges the knife deep into his heart, and turns it twice.
God. And Kay's final words, they really hammer home the theme of dehumanization, don't they?
They're devastating. As he lies dying, he sees a figure flicker in a window of a nearby house. Who is it? Justice. God. A random observer. We don't know. But Kay's final thought, his last words whispered, are, "like a dog."
As if he's just being disposed of. No dignity, no meaning, just dispatched by this impersonal machine that never even told him why.
Exactly. Processed and eliminated. His life ends with the same abrupt, inexplicable quality that marked the beginning of his arrest.
Okay, let's try to synthesize this for someone trying to grasp the novel's impact. If we connect these plot points, these horrific moments, back to the main themes, what are the key takeaways? First, clearly, is the tyranny of bureaucracy.
Absolutely. The court isn't driven by some mustache-twirling villain. It's... horror comes from its impersonality, its self-serving procedures, its endless paperwork and delays. It just grinds people down through sheer, pointless complexity, something I think we can all recognize in dealings with large organizations today, right?
Unfortunately, yes. Then there's the theme of existential guilt, the fact that the crime is never named. It forces you, the reader, to wonder if Kay is guilty just by being.
Right. The priest mentions the court is attracted by guilt. Does that mean guilt precedes the accusation? Is simply existing in this confusing world enough to make one culpable in the eyes of some higher, inscrutable power? Kafka leaves that disturbingly open.
And finally, alienation.
Yeah.
Kay becomes utterly isolated, doesn't he?
Completely.
Oh, yeah.
His predicament is unique. Nobody truly understands or can help him. His relationships with Fräulein Bürstner early on, with Lenny, even his interactions with his uncle or Titorelli, they all become transactional, distorted by his case.
Yeah.
He's fundamentally alone against this incomprehensible system.
So the trial, written over a century ago, feels eerily relevant. It's not just a story. It's almost like a foundational myth for our age of opaque systems, endless digital forms, the feeling of being lost in structures we can't control or even fully see.
It really is. It poses that uncomfortable question. Are our own struggles against the huge impersonal forces shaping our lives, governments, corporations, algorithms, ultimately as bewildering and potentially futile as Joseph Kay's journey through the court? How do we live meaningfully within systems that seem designed to deny that very possibility?
A question that certainly lingers.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.